I'd actually like to take a moment to thank all of the notable speakers who have shared their thoughts and ideas about modern-day China and historic China and the wide variety of subjects, including the arts and culture, the environment, politics, society, the economy, and the future of this fascinating country. I'd like to thank Melissa Chu, Yan Li, Heidi Jacobson-Zuckerman, Rod McFarquhar, Du Wei Ming, Cheng Li, Jim Fellows, Orville Schell, Bruce Babbitt, David Dollar, Peter Glick, Jim Steinberg, Min-Chin Pei, Clive Crook, and David Bradley, whom I have the pleasure of introducing to you this morning. David is the chairman and owner of a number of publishing, news, and media properties, including The Atlantic and National Journal. Throughout his career, David has been and continues to be a force of big ideas. He founded the advisory board company and the corporate executive board, the largest employers of young professional talent in the Washington area, and has worked with the White House and the White House Conference on Children and Youth. Please help me welcome David Bradley this morning.
Good morning.
Whoa, is that coming on too strong for you?
That was a very nice introduction, Claudia. Thank you very much. Let me in turn thank DHL. DHL has been a sponsor of this whole track. DHL is a sponsor of this program. I don't know that I know of a company that is more committed to China or more engaged by the intellectual issues which we're going to be discussing this morning than DHL. Thank you for your company's generosity. Purely as a matter of coincidence, I am just returned from a 19-day family trip to six different regions of China. I don't want to pretend that that makes me an authority on all U.S.-Sino relations, but I come back an authority at least as to these two things. The first is that 19 days is way at the outer limit of how long you should travel with your family, even when you really love your family. 18 days, 17 days, nature did not intend 19. And I hope this doesn't sort of detract in any way from the magnitude or scale of Mao's accomplishment in the 1934 Great March. But Mao did not travel for 19 days in a van with five children across the country. Second insight, if you had to identify, if you were to tour the world and you had to choose the people who by their nature or their wiring or their soul or their inner zeitgeist were most perfectly attuned to Marxism, you couldn't choose worse than the Chinese people. I was at a vendor fair, what they call the antiquities market in Shanghai. It's antiquities is sort of a term of art there. It means the Cultural Revolution. So you're seeing stall after stall after stall of mugs and cups and plates and swords and knickknacks with Mao or Chou En-lai's photo on it. And as I was walking through this, I was approached by a very insistent shoeshine man who reached the view that I had agreed to a shoeshine before I reached the view that I agreed to a shoe shine, but he won, and there I was standing up with him shining my shoes. And when he saw that I was settled in, he took out a folder, and in it was a newspaper clipping, and there was a photograph of him, you could recognize him, shining the shoes of Bill Gates, and you could recognize Bill Gates. And he said, "Bill Gates, Bill Gates," and maybe 8 or 10 Chinese came around, circled around, wanted to see the photograph. Everybody started saying, "Bill Gates, Bill Gates," and there was a happiness and an excitement and an honest upwelling of good feeling about it that can't possibly be what those sullen mugs of Chou En-lai and Mao Zedong had in mind for their proletariat. It's that, Bill Gates, that brings us to this conversation today. We are met to discuss an international debate that is being joined in international economy, and that is whether this extraordinary Chinese economic miracle is sustainable. And for a roadmap, what I thought I would do is introduce the three panelists. I'd see if they would make an opening statement. I'll put out enough questions to jumpstart a conversation, but I'd love to then shift the burden to you to be engaging the panel in conversation for what I take to be a run that goes to 10:15. So let me introduce the panelists, if I may. I have Min-Chin Pei directly to my right. Min-Chin is the director of the China program at the Carnegie Endowment. He is one of the hot young public intellectuals in the China field. When we got his bio, it had a list of the major public speaking events that he's appeared at since 2001. It goes on page after page after page. Min-Chin told me at breakfast today that he was out speaking 120 days of last year. He is a great itinerant preacher, breaking bread and delivering. He's the Billy Graham of our panel today. To his right is David Dollar. In an old Henry Lucian phrase, David is an old China hand. His studies are in Chinese and economics, a BA at Dartmouth in Chinese history and Chinese language, and then a PhD at NYU. He is the country director for the World Bank for China and Mongolia, and he's posted in Beijing. I don't know David's views deeply on the subject of the Chinese economic miracle, but as to free markets generally, and especially as to the free market's ability to lift all boats, to actually address poverty, David is an arrestingly optimistic economist. And then to his right is one of my favorite Atlantic colleagues ever. This is Clive Crook. Clive was a 20-year writer and editor for The Economist. He rose to the number two spot, the deputy editor. He was the keeper of the intellectual faith. He was the one that created the Economist worldview. If you like the Economist world take on issues, that is Clive. If you don't like the Economist world take, well, I don't want you reading other magazines anyway, so just as well. Took a long time to recruit Clive, and he's now a writer for the National Journal and for the Atlantic, and his discipline is international economics. My staff preparing for this gave me sort of the serious literature on this debate of whither goes the international, the Chinese economic miracle. I haven't seen such a deep, serious literature. I haven't had to read it for a long time. It reminds me of those huge black notebooks I used to be given when at least a number of us in the healthcare field were trying to master the Hillary Clinton health care plans in the 1990s. I know a number of you in the room are China experts or are economists, so this isn't for you, but there's some layman here, and I thought what I'd do is do a sort of Monarch Notes primer on this debate about the Chinese economy and level the playing field for those who are auditing this course. So let me start with the case for continuing success. What we're now seeing is an economic miracle that is simply unprecedented. China has been growing its GDP at 10% or more year after year after year after year. It had 10.7% GDP growth last year, only 1.7% inflation. It's the fourth largest economy in the world. It's likely to be the second largest economy by the year 2020. There's some chance it could surpass the United States and become the first largest economy by the year 2050. The whole of this is powered by a one-piston engine. It's this remarkable 30-year manufacturing export machine that has been developed. China now has $1 trillion in central bank reserves. The trade surplus with the United States alone last year was $233 billion. China represented 30% of our U.S. trade deficit. Since 1980, it's said that 300 million people have been brought into the Chinese middle class, that as many as 400 million have been lifted up out of desperate poverty. I had done an email exchange with Clive last week, and he wrote me this paragraph in an email. China is realizing the most remarkable economic transformation in human history. In terms both of scale and speed, the world has seen nothing remotely like it. On present trends, it will achieve in this century a degree of global and economic dominance that no other country, including the United States, has previously achieved. So let's go to the other side. Let's go to the doubts. China is a nation that utterly derailed in the 20th century. In 1820, China had 30% of the world's population and roughly 30% of the world's GDP. As this 21st century began, China still had a large population, 20% of the world's population, but it only had 5% of the world's GDP. Yes, there are 300 million Chinese middle class, as a global hedge fund analyst puts it, but there are 1 billion people still left in the 7th century. The scale of what China has to do just to stay even is beyond reasonable expectation. It has to add about 20 million people per year to the modern workforce. That's like taking 2/3 of Canada and adding it to the economy. This, at least in their belief, is the reason they need to do this 10% growth, but not just this year, next year and next year and next year until they get to this demographic turn, which I know our panel is going to discuss. So what could derail this 10% growth run? Well, three problems that I'll cite, although they are just myriad in the literature. One is the problem of rural unrest. China has the greatest income inequality of all of Asia. The cities are gaining, the coast is gaining, central China, western China, rural China is stagnating, or at least being left behind. The top wealthiest 1% of the Chinese own 60% of the private assets in the country. The question, this rural question is, what's to become of 1 billion people left behind? The number two problem I'll put forward is China's mega cities and the mega crisis that attends to it. Between 1980 and 2005, 100 million Chinese moved from the rural areas into the cities. It's the largest human migration in the history of our species. Between the years 2005 and 2025, it's expected that another 400 to 600 million will move into the cities. So what's to become of the cities? One manifestation of this problem is pollution, air pollution. China is expected next year to surpass the United States and become the largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world. And here it is at the beginning of its energy surge. And the third problem is the ancien regime. But it actually serves better just to the English, the ancient regime, the old creaky authoritarian Chinese Communist Party, CCP. The CCP is reasonably opaque to most Westerners. We don't know a lot about it. It's thought, at least by one analyst, to have at its center somewhere between 12 and 120 people who really have almost all of the power, political power in the country. Whatever that number is, this is not a talent meritocracy. This is an older group of people. It's a political party full of political careerists, bureaucrats, military officers. So one shot, upshot of this undemocratic, centralized power is that with the gaining wealth, you end up with a plutocratic class and an enormous amount of corruption. The state in China continues to have almost a monopoly position in some of the hugest industries, in financial services, telecom, steel, energy, auto. And this is the center of an awful lot of this financial corruption. But probably the larger problem for the CCP is what happens when you have an older authoritative state come face to face with its own burgeoning middle class with rising sophistication, rising wealth, and rising exposure to the West. So what I thought I'd do in starting this conversation is see if I could get, I guess we'll go in the order of the panelists. I'll go to Min Qin, then to David, and then to Clive. Start with Min Qin and ask him if he would give the skeptic's view, no matter what your own view is. Take the skeptic's position. David, would you come back and say, no, here's some reason for optimism. And as Clive is in Washington and all over the U.S. debate, I thought I might ask him to open up about U.S.-Chinese relations and what's the thinking in political circles about China. Min Qin, would you
Excellent.
Want to start?
Thank you. I would give the skeptic's view, not because I'm assigned to do this, but because I also believe in this perspective. I would call myself a cautious pessimist. I'm not predicting doom or collapse. I'm forecasting a more complex scenario. I would say in the next 7 to 10 years, you're going to see the peaking of the China miracle or China's economic rise. Then after that, there will be a period of erosion of economic momentum, rising tensions. then what will happen, I really do not know. That's where my predictive power fails. Of course, I can conjure up different outcomes. For the next 7 to 10 year time frame, there are several very positive factors for China. Savings will remain very high, and economic growth relies primarily on savings rate, which provides investment. And the Chinese economic growth model is heavily dependent on high investment. China saves around 42-43% of its GDP and invests about as much. And with that kind of investment, you're going to have enormous expansion of capital and creating capacity for production and exports. So for the next 7-10 years, savings will constitute the most powerful engine of economic growth. The second positive factor is urban-rural labor migration, which creates two favorable conditions for growth. One is urbanization. Urbanization in China today is another domestic growth engine. Infrastructure, housing, services, just enormous momentum. The other is the flow of low-cost labor. Younger, relatively healthy, reasonably well-educated Chinese rural residents flowing into urban areas, doing construction, service jobs, manufacturing jobs. That will continue for another 7 to 10, maybe 15 years. And then the third is China's deep integration into the global economy. China's another growth engine for Chinese export growth, 10, 15, 20% a year. China today is already the third largest exporter in the world and will soon be the world's largest. And that will continue for another 7 to 10 years, unless, as we will explain later on, China runs into problems abroad in terms of foreign backlash against Chinese exports. These positive factors will disappear, will gradually disappear around 2015 to 2020. Then what will happen? What will happen is that at the same time, while these positive factors are driving the Chinese economy, there are several very negative trends in the Chinese economy that will progressively become more severe and probably will be very, very severe in 10, 15 years. Let me just list them. The first one is the imbalances in the economy, because the Chinese economy is dependent on investment. And China needs ever more investment in order to sustain the current level of economic growth. 40% of GDP year in, year out investment. Clearly, in 10, 15 years, you're talking about a huge base. That's not sustainable. And investment also creates overcapacity, and that will have consequences on the financial system. And third is that the demographic trends in China are clearly unfavorable. 10, 15 years from now, China will become an aging society. Low-cost labor will be much less abundant. China probably will have a labor shortage by 2020. Then that will impact China's savings rate, because older folks consume rather than save. So savings rate will come down as well. And then the current model of growth in China produces two deficits. One is the environmental deficit, enormous environmental degradation in China. Even though the Chinese government is taking measures to deal with that. In the area of water shortage, air pollution, and soil contamination, soil erosion, the current trends are very, very unfavorable. And we don't know how the economy can absorb the ever-rising cost of environmental degradation. The other deficit is what I call social deficit, is that by over-investing in physical assets, the current government policies discourage investment in human capital, access to healthcare, access to education. And then that, even though China has experienced a very rapid rise in wealth, investment in these two areas, in relative terms, has been either stagnating or declining. And that is an indirect contributor to rising inequality in China. Because if you go to China, you will find this paradox. The economy is growing high, but people's complaints are very, very intense. What are they complaining about? They're not complaining about lack of democracy, human rights. They're complaining about expensive housing, expensive healthcare, expensive education. So the social consensus for the current economic growth, if nothing is down, will erode. Today, I think it's already eroding because the Chinese economic reform is based on a so-called implicit social contract. It is that let some people get rich first, and then the entire society will get rich together later on. But the second part of the bargain has not yet been delivered. And what you have seen is an explosive growth in economic and social inequality. So the final question is, can the current government deal with this problem? I'm very doubtful because of the paradoxical effect of good times on reform. No government takes tough reform measures when times are good. So the next 7 to 8 year time frame, when we're talking about continued economic growth, because the raw momentum is strong and these positive factors are present, they actually act against reform in China. So the current government will simply let the good times roll, even though they are aware of the rising risks. So by the time all the unfavorable trends converge in China around 2015, 2020, then I think we're going to see a much more difficult time for the Chinese government. That's why I would say that by the time I would no longer, I'm almost absolutely sure of myself that you're not going to see China growing at 10%. China will be very lucky to grow at 7%.
David, okay. So I've asked to be something of the optimist on the panel. I can see our DHL hosts are already a little bit alarmed after listening to Min Shin. But I think the good news is I think that the most likely scenario is that China will continue to grow well for at least another 15 years. I like to call myself a cautious optimist because I think there's a good chance this optimistic scenario will play out. But I'm cautious because I basically agree with Min Shin about the diagnostic of the problem. So I think the fundamentals are in place for China to continue to grow well. You know, it has this large rural-urban migration that's creating a large urban labor force. It's a very open economy that's well connected to the global market. And many Chinese cities have created a good investment climate where Chinese entrepreneurship is generating a lot of private investment in innovation and development. All those fundamentals remain in place for about 15 years. But I agree with Min Shin that there are some very serious risks. I see the three biggest risks to be the environment, the social deficit, and also the trade imbalance. The reason I can be a cautious optimist is that I think that the government is moving in each of these three areas. So let me just say a few words about each area, starting with environment. I really do think natural resource scarcity and environmental degradation is the single biggest challenge that China faces. It's a natural resource scarce country. The whole country has a pretty serious water shortage, and the northern half of the country has a really acute water shortage. And almost half the people live in the northern half of the country. So you've got a water shortage, you've got serious pollution of water all around China. You also have serious air pollution. China has 20 of the 30 most air-polluted cities in the world, and we've just worked together with the Environmental Agency in China to do the first careful estimate of the health costs of air and water pollution in China, and the health costs are really quite alarming. So I think the environmental issues are serious. You read about them all the time in the New York Times and other Western outlets. What you may not be aware of is that in most environmental areas, there is progress in China. So air pollution has improved in a majority of Chinese cities. Particularly in the southern part of the country, there's been pretty dramatic declines in air pollution. Water pollution in the southern part of the country in the early 1990s, almost no river system had drinkable water, and now more than 60% of the rivers in the south have drinkable water. So there have been clear measures that have been taken to try to improve and address some of these environmental issues. So I'm somewhat optimistic that that trend will continue. I would say I think a key part of that is pricing natural resources appropriately. China has tended to have low energy and water prices, and they have been gradually raising the price of water and the price of energy, and that's one factor this led to conservation and to better use. But I'd like to paint a balanced picture of a pretty serious environmental crisis, but progress in some parts of the country. It's interesting that it's in some parts of the country. I think Chinese cities compete with each other. They used to compete just to attract investment. They used to want to attract the big polluting industries. Now I see a lot of Chinese cities competing to try to create a greener environment because they realize that a good living environment is part of being competitive. So you've got cities like Hangzhou and Suzhou that are working very hard to create a better living environment because they want to attract engineers and top flight talent to compete with Silicon Valley. Second key issue for China is this social deficit. China has developed a very high degree of inequality, similar to the level of inequality in the United States. But the way to think about this is that urban incomes in China are going up at 10 to 12% per year. Rural real incomes are going up at 5 to 6% per year. So that generates a lot of inequality, but I emphasize that rural real incomes are going up much more rapidly than anywhere else in the world, so there continues to be very rapid poverty reduction. Just between 2001 and 2004, China cut its poverty by one-third in 3 years. So it is true that this rapid growth is benefiting everyone in the country materially. It's just benefiting the people in the cities much more so than people in the countryside. In China, the income inequality is a particularly serious issue because the country has a very decentralized fiscal system where local governments generally have to pay for health and education. So where you have poor rural communities, they're supposed to pay to educate their own children and provide health, and they're at a very serious disadvantage. So China is at risk of having this inequality perpetuate itself because the poor areas cannot provide good social services. So I think that is a very serious issue for the country. There's a lot of social unrest around some of the inequality issues. Again, though, I do see some areas of progress. In the most recent budget, the government made a very significant increase in the amount of money going to rural education and rural health, and I think that the budget is taking quite seriously the issue of putting more money into rural health, rural education, rural development more generally. I guess an economist would say the obvious solution to the inequality problem is to speed up the migration of people from the countryside to the cities. For a long time, the Chinese government resisted migration, restricted it through a registration system. That registration system is slowly breaking down. The best hope for dealing with the inequality is to make it easy for people to leave the countryside and move to cities, and we're beginning to see some evidence of that. Now, the third issue I mentioned briefly is the trade imbalance. I actually think the trade deficit from the U.S. side is not a particularly big issue, not that important, and happy to discuss that. But I think from the Chinese side, the trade imbalance really is a problem. China's trade surplus has reached 10% of GDP. Quite a bit of China's growth comes from increasing the trade surplus every year. Now that China is a big player in the world market, there just are not going to be markets, even without political interference, but protectionism. They're just not going to be markets that can absorb a big increase year after year. China is still a developing country, so the 10% trade surplus, 10% of GDP trade surplus, means that China is exporting capital of 10% of GDP every year, which frankly just doesn't make sense for a poor country. I like to joke that every Chinese peasant implicitly owns $1,000 of U.S. Treasury bonds, so the nice low return instrument that you can be sure you'll get a capital loss on that. You may not have a tractor, you may not be able to send your kids to school, but the government is holding $1,000 of treasury bonds on your behalf. It just simply doesn't make economic sense. So I think addressing the trade imbalance is an important short-run challenge for China. Now, I want to end by saying there's a very obvious policy package to address all three of these challenges simultaneously. If the government would more aggressively raise the price of energy and water and enforce environmental standards, they can address the environmental issues more forcefully. That by itself would tend to make Chinese people poorer. If all of a sudden the price of gasoline doubles or the price of water doubles, that would tend to make Chinese people poorer. But if you let the exchange rate appreciate 10% or so, that by itself tends to make Chinese people richer, and also that by itself tends to be deflationary and would mitigate the effect of raising the price of energy and water. And then that would, of course, slow down the export machine, which is something the government's concerned about,
But ironically, if you ask the government now, why don't you spend a lot more on health and education? They've made some increases, but if you say, why don't you spend dramatically more on health and education, they'll say, we're worried about overheating of the economy. So if you allowed some exchange rate appreciation to cool off the manufacturing sector, you could actually pump a lot of public money into health and education, which would meet real needs and stimulate the macroeconomy. So there's an obvious policy package that would keep China growing at a very healthy rate, but address the environmental and social deficits much more forcefully than is occurring. And then the obvious question to ask is, why aren't they doing it? And there I would say that the senior leadership is gradually doing this. So you do see increases in energy and water prices. We've seen a little bit of appreciation of the exchange rate. We've seen a 20% increase in the government spending on rural health and education. And from my point of view, I would like to see more rapid movement on this policy package. But I do see movement on the policy package. And if China continues down that path, I think they can grow successfully in a more balanced way, meet their needs, take some of the pressure off the international imbalances, and DHL can make a lot of money by investing successfully in China. So that's the optimistic scenario.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay. Clive, how much do we love China these days?
Well, let me just preface the answer to that by saying my credentials don't allow me to be anything except a cautious agnostic on China. I'm not a China watcher. I'm a U.S. economic policy watcher. But that dimension of the issue leans, I think, to the pessimistic end of the scale. I'm not qualified to comment on where the balance lies, but I think there is a hardening of attitudes in the U.S. in general and in Washington in particular against Chinese trade policies. And there's been recently a particularly severe rise in sentiment that says that China's currency policy is harming the U.S. Obviously, China is such a huge economy, such a massive force in the world, that its relationship with other countries and with the U.S. in particular is a critical dimension of its prospects. I mean, one way to think of it is to say, is the rest of the world, is the U.S. going to let this export miracle continue? And I think the balance of sentiment in Washington at the moment is that if the U.S. could stop it, it would. I've been very struck by how many, as I think of them, you know, by how many moderate, pragmatic economists, economic thinkers in, you know, the think tank circuit in D.C. have switched over from a position of applauding and celebrating China's economic miracle to a focus on the harm that China's economic miracle is doing to the U.S. Institutions that previously defended, a very gentle, as it were, a gentle accommodation to China's policies are now rattling the saber and saying enough is enough. There's legislation in Congress at the moment that would designate China as a currency manipulator, which I think is a very sort of inflammatory term. I mean, in one sense, it's correct. China pegs its exchange rate. Okay, it's manipulating the currency. So far as I'm aware, there's no rule in the world economy that makes that illegal. But the vocabulary now in Washington is moving very strongly in the direction of saying that this is cheating, this is unfair, your growth is at our expense. And the legislation in Congress, as I say, would designate China as a currency manipulator and set in train a series of steps that would end with the U.S. imposing various kinds of import protection against China, countervailing duties and the rest of it. This is a path that leads to, I think, possibly quite bitter trade conflict between the U.S. and China. Now, I want to express my own view on whether the U.S. is right to take this position. I think it's wrong. It's wrong in every respect. It's a false diagnosis of the problem. I don't think China's trade surplus, David indicated that he agreed with this, I don't think China's trade surplus is a particularly significant problem for the U.S. I think it's much more of a problem for China. I think if China did everything that people in Congress who are militating against China's policy wanted and let the RMB appreciate very substantially, and even if the rest of Asia followed that appreciation with currency appreciations of their own, the effect on America's current account deficit would be modest. The main force behind America's current account deficit is domestic spending in the U.S., the lack of domestic savings, and the U.S. budget deficit. And until those problems are addressed, America is going to continue to have a colossal trade deficit. And if it isn't principally with China on the other end, it will be with other countries instead on the other side of that deficit. So I think the diagnosis is false. And tactically, I think it's a mistake to press China to appreciate faster than the Chinese leadership feels it's in its own interest to do so. I do think, again, David touched on this, China would be better off if it let the RMB appreciate gradually. I have some sympathy for the view that once they let the RMB begin to appreciate, that process might run out of control. And there are dangers if it does run out of control for China and actually for the world economy. So I don't think it's absolutely obvious that what they're doing now is crazy. But I think on balance, it would make sense for China to let the RMB appreciate, to stop accumulating reserves, and to let its trade surplus fall. But if China doesn't see that, I would be very surprised if it bends to American insistence that it do that. And in fact, I think American pressure on China to let the RMB appreciate may even be counterproductive, because it makes the leadership seem as though it's kowtowing to outside pressure. And I think the record on that in China is not encouraging. I think the stance that the U.S. and other countries should take to China is one based more on equal partnership, which I think is something that the U.S. finds difficult to do with other countries in the trade area. There is a common interest in a gradually appreciated RMB, and I may say in fiscal control in the U.S., which would also take pressure off these imbalances in the world economy. And I think America's approach to China should be based more on a search for consensus of that kind. I think actually that's where the administration is. The administration is already locked into a process that requires it to come to a view each year about whether China is a currency manipulator. And just before this new legislation surfaced in Congress, the Treasury Department ruled that China was not a currency manipulator, and therefore, you know, the subsequent steps that would have put pressure on China did not begin. While that was not a popular stance, most Democrats in Congress and a great many Republicans think that this approach is mistaken. And I think it's only a matter of time before the U.S. begins to put more pressure on China to let the currency appreciate. And I think that does pose risks, both for the Chinese economy and for the U.S. So I do think this, you know, this question of where China fits into the world economy and how we bring China's economic decision-making into a global framework alongside America's economic decision-making is a very big question, a very big risk going forward.
Clive and David, the literature is replete with concern about an asset bubble bursting and comparisons to the Japanese meltdown at the beginning of the 90s. Clive, would you do a 30-second thumbnail of what happened in Japan and how long it lasted? And then, David, would you address, is there the prospect of a China crash coming soon?
Well, I think, you know, there is a parallel here. I mean, Japan had asset price inflation across the economy, house prices massively out of line, hugely overvalued, stock market, and so forth. There were clear bubble elements in it. You know, speculative fervor drove this thing. And once the bubble burst in Japan, the results were much more devastating than I think people had expected. The problem was not so much that the bubble burst, but the remedies available to revive the economy did not work. You know, they were trapped in a very low inflation, deinflation environment, so the conventional instruments for restoring economic growth didn't kick in. You know, you can't cut interest rates to less than zero, for instance. And Japan was in that problem and stayed there, you know, for years. I don't think, I'll let David say more about this because he knows such more about China, but I'd be surprised if China followed that path, because its asset price inflation is not as wired into the rest of the economy as was the case in Japan. I mean, the asset price collapse in Japan affected every segment of the economy in a very dramatic way. I think the results of an asset price collapse in China, which could happen because they do have overvalued asset prices, but it would be more confined, it would be more focused, and I would be amazed, actually, if the results of an asset price shock in China were as bad as they were in Japan. But David, you say.
Yeah, so a couple of points on this. So first, I think, I'm glad you brought this up, because I do think the Chinese are looking at that Japanese experience, and one of the reasons why China is so reluctant to have a large appreciation of the exchange rate is they think that was one of the key factors precipitating the crisis. So, and I also want to say, I have some sympathy for the leadership in China not wanting a large, sharp appreciation. And that, so I think, and it's not an easy thing to manage, but I do think kind of gradual, more moderate appreciation is more sensible. Now, in the financial crisis, financial issues, there is some evidence of asset bubbles starting to develop in the stock market in China and in certain housing markets, though not in all Chinese cities. If I were a Chinese policymaker, I would be concerned about this, because I do think the stock prices are getting out of line with the underlying fundamentals, and I think some of the housing prices are getting out of line. Some correction would be a healthy thing. That's not an easy thing to engineer. I don't see any potential at this point for a big crisis, because if there were a sharp drop in the stock market and in, say, Shanghai and Beijing housing prices, it would hurt some people, most of whom are relatively wealthy people, but I don't think it has much connection to the real economy. You know, most of the Chinese firms are not financing themselves off the stock market. The stock market's a little bit of a sideshow there. So I don't see it being that connected to the real economy. Some of what's happening in stocks and houses, of course, some of that's financed by the banking system. If there's a contraction, we'll suddenly discover there are a lot more bad loans than we thought. But because China has those $1.3 trillion in reserves, they have a great insurance policy. So even if there were pretty significant losses in the financial system, it's hard to see how it could turn into a more general macroeconomic crisis because they have that great fiscal strength behind them.
Wonderful. One more question, and then if I can, I'd love to engage all of you in questions. Minxin, what keeps the CCP awake at night? Are they at all at risk of losing control? And if it ever were to happen, what's the thing that could do it?
Two things. One is the emergence of an organized opposition, the so-called color revolutions in the former Soviet bloc gave the Chinese leadership a nightmare. They somehow believe that all of this was a conspiracy between unhappy groups within those countries and Western governments and NGOs. So they've done a great deal to contain Western NGOs and Chinese NGOs. So this is one, political. The other is an unexpected economic shock. Asset bubble, foreign trade disruption, or energy shock. Because when the economy is growing at 10-11%, you have so many unhappy people. Just imagine, in the aftermath of a shock, the kind of social discontent, and more importantly, that will create an opportunity for certain elements within the leadership to mount a bid for power. So they are really, really worried about the convergence of several trends or forces at a time of maximum unpleasant surprise.
Let me open it up, see if there's some questions from the audience. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm Ash Carter. I wanted to get a different dimension of the conversation going, get the participants' reaction, which is the relationship between the external conduct of China, which we haven't talked about, its strategic and political face that it puts on the world, and the latitude it is going to have to deal with these problems. I mean, I would say China's had a very free ride for 30 years. But its footprint around the world is getting heavier. Certainly in the United States, we observe things like the military competition, the anti-satellite test that was conducted 3 months ago. We observe nationalism in the young. We observe the tendency always in history for countries that have internal tensions and frustrations to direct them outward. So all of this is going to play, not just in the United States, but around the world as well. And can you say something about, you've been acting as though they can deal with all this within a stable international context, and I'm not sure that's true. And it's not just trade backlash from the United States, it's strategic backlash in the United States and elsewhere in the world.
Do you want... Clive?
Let me say something about, could I just say something quickly about the Washington side of it? My perception is not that China's been given a free ride. I mean, membership of the WTO is an important instance of how China, expressed a willingness to play by the international rules of the game. That was quite a striking gesture on China's part, I think, and something that was very good for everybody else. It drew China into a sort of a process where a more consensual approach to resolving issues is available. What China does have, I don't doubt, is a sort of sensitivity bordering on paranoia about sovereignty, about its pride and its standing in the world. China wants to be recognized as a power and treated with respect. And I think it's incumbent on other countries. I mean, there's so many things about the way China is run I object to, but I do think it's incumbent on other countries to recognize and understand that sensitivity and not be too abrupt in saying to China, you've had it good for so long and we're not willing to put up with this any longer. The emphasis on sovereignty, on if we think this is in our interest, we will do it, is a very American sentiment. You know, when I watched the debate in Washington about how China, should submit to what the rest of the world wants on trade, I asked myself, well, what would American politicians think of a Chinese position that said, you've been promising to deal with your budget deficit for years. The fact that the budget deficit is still there is screwing up the world economy. It's about time you did something about it. And if you don't, we will act against you. Can you imagine the reaction in Washington to that kind of demand? But China is on the receiving end of that increasingly from the West. As I said in my first remarks, I think the West's view is wrong in substance in many cases, but also that just strikes me as bad tactics. I get the sense, in short, that China is willing, more willing than we think, to play by the rules, but it wants to be recognized as an equal partner in working out what the rules are. Are we ready to give them that standing? That's the issue in my mind.
Very quickly, I think there are momentary lapses in Chinese foreign policy. Security policy, anti-satellite, obviously, was one. And a few years ago, tensions with Japan, another. And then even more a few years back, tensions with Taiwan. But by and large, the Chinese government has a rather conservative status quo bias foreign policy. Not because the Chinese Communist Party fundamentally loves peace, but because the Chinese Communist Party understands perfectly well that its own survival depends on a peaceful international environment. That's why if you compare China with Russia, you will find China a paragon of cooperation and restraint, because China does not make empty threats against the West, and China bends backward, even when it gets kicked in the face, not Russia. The only difference is in Russia, Putin is far more secure politically, domestically, than the Chinese government. So there's this unholy symbiosis between the survival of the Chinese government, the Communist Party, and the Western desire for international peace.
I'd like to use Ashton's question to bring... give me just one moment to bring into the conversation Two men have spent part of their years in the Senate. We have former Senator Tim Worth, Democrat from Colorado, and Richard Durbin. Senator Durbin is Democrat from Illinois right now, and the number two Democrat in the Senate. Senator Durbin, would you be willing to speak to for a moment to the mood in the majority party towards China? If you had to say, what do the Democrats think of China?
Thank you for that, and thanks for allowing me to join you this morning. I think there are several perspectives that are dominant. Reference was made to this currency manipulation. I think my roommate and colleague Chuck Schumer has been involved in that with Lindsey Graham. Impact on American manufacturing as to whether or not we can truly be competitive if, in fact, their currency is not reflective of the reality of their economy. But I would say there are two things that are more dominant at the moment. The first is the quality of Chinese imports. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is a small agency, but it's supposed to keep us safe from goods and products that might harm us. Each year, two-thirds of the products that they investigate are imports, and two-thirds of those are from China. So 50% of their agenda is about Chinese imports. Each month, the Food and Drug Administration publishes the name of the countries that are exporting food to the United States that are the most dangerous, have to be recalled or stopped. Every month, China ranks either one or two in terms of the most dangerous food exports to the United States. Now we've seen in the last 5 or 6 months the pet food scandal, the concern about fish, the concern about toys with lead paint. There is an emerging concern about the safety of imports from China. I can remember as a teenager when Made in Japan had a connotation to it that is not reflected in the Lexus that's parked outside. Things have changed. I don't know where China is when it comes to quality control, but at one point they would not even allow us to send our inspectors into China to look at the plants that were exporting the protein that had been laced with melamine to make it more valuable. They changed their tune and eventually allowed us to come in. But that's number one issue, is Chinese imports. Number two is one that hasn't been mentioned. Chinese foreign policy may generally be benign, but I think when it comes to resources, that it is not benign. Witness Darfur. We have declared a genocide in Darfur. The Bush administration, Secretary Powell, Secretary Rice, the United Nations. And yet we find that the number one company in Sudan generating income for their government to sustain the genocide is PetroChina, the Chinese oil company. The only time that China has been tweaked into acting recently was when Mia Farrow wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal chiding Japan with its ambitions for One World, One Dream Olympics, and Steven Spielberg in particular, for not saying enough about the genocide in Darfur and the nation of China. So I would say those are the three: the currency, the quality of imports, and the issue in Darfur.
Thank you, Senator. Take the mic, if you will.
Yes, my name is Arturo Thompson, and I have no political position. That is, I have no political office, or not much of any other office. But I want to say something, which I see. I hear these protectionist arguments over and over again. I say, yawn, here we go again with the same old mercantilism. I want to make a statement. I'd like you people to tell me why I'm totally out of my mind, and anybody else in this room. In the best possible economy, if I were a country, I could have with trade would be to import everything and export absolutely nothing. Because when I bring goods in, I gain wealth. When I pay for those with American goods, I'm losing wealth. Now, that's my statement. And so I think everything protectionists say is totally upside down. They got it totally wrong. If the Chinese want to kill themselves giving me a cheap drill, I'll take that drill. I don't know why they want to work so cheaply. And by the way, the quality of the machine tools I bought from China is pretty darn good. But, I mean, I don't even know why they want to work so cheaply. But as long as they do, I'm going to buy those Chinese goods and I'm going to get wealthier because I've got more goods and I don't care about scraps of paper called money. So that's my statement. Now tell me why I'm crazy. Thank you.
The question is, why is the speaker crazy?
The question is, why am I crazy? Why am I crazy for saying that protectionism has got it all backwards? Thank
you. I have some sympathy for what you're saying. If you recall, what I said is I don't see the trade imbalance as being a particularly big issue for the United States economy.
We want an imbalance.
Right. So I have some sympathy with what you're saying, because what I stated was that I think for China to have this large trade surplus, you know, in some sense, they're giving America real stuff. And you know, I very much take the senator's point that there's concern about the quality of some things, but I also take your point that a lot of things made in China are quite good.
But that's a health issue.
Stuff, and they're taking American paper in return, on which in the long run they're certainly going to get a 30% or 40% capital loss. So at some level, you know, that's pretty irrational. And I made that point that I don't see why this poor country, relatively poor country, should be subsidized in the United States. Now, having said that, one thing to keep in mind is that when we get these trade imbalances in either direction, they don't affect every sector of the economy evenly, because some things are widely traded internationally and some are not. So I do have some sympathy for American manufacturing industry that having a large trade deficit tends to put pressure on the manufacturing sector, the traded goods sector. It's more of a boon for the service sectors. But I agree with what Clive Crook said, that I think the fundamental issue for the U.S. is the lack of savings. So if you want to address the trade imbalance from the U.S. side, I would favor reducing the federal deficit and taking other measures that would stimulate savings in the United States, and that would actually take care of the situation. I also feel a lot of sympathy. I used to work for the Clothing and Textile Workers Union, and I feel a lot of sympathy for the workers who were thrown out of work. So I don't think we should be cavalier and say America benefits from getting these imports, so let's not worry about textile workers, or let's not worry about some of the workers who are hurt. So I'm in favor of intelligent adjustment policies. Now, it's not easy to design, but I think we should make more of an effort in the United States to cushion some of the shocks of globalization for the less skilled workers and for some people down at the bottom of the income distribution. I would have a progressive agenda of how to help some of the groups that are hurt, but I'm very alarmed about this protectionist movement, which I do think is ultimately going to really hurt the United States and hurt the world economy.
And isn't it the same old tired argument? I mean, it's the same old thing that you think, oh, we want to export, we don't want to import, we don't want all those foreign goods. You're sending wealth out of the country when you export.
Well, if you just think about it intuitively, you know, if you forget about countries and just think more broadly, you know, most communities produce a few things and they import everything else from other communities. That's how market economy works. That's what makes us rich. If you tried to produce clothing, food, automobiles by yourself in your own house, it would be impossible. You would be poor. So wealth is based on commerce, on trade, and the bigger the market, the more innovation, the more benefits we get from it. So I'm a big believer in a big open market, but then I think we have to cushion the blows to some of the people who are hurt during the adjustment.
But I didn't want to dominate, but doesn't all rapid economic progress involve lots of dislocations? Isn't that just part and parcel? And maybe we ought to just suck it up and say, that's the way the world works, and stop whining about it and find a new job.
Let's ask the classic liberal.
Yeah, I'm 9/10 of the way to your position. I mean, I think one of the things that's wrong with saying, let's just, you know, the ideal thing would be to export nothing and import, you know, a ton of stuff. In the end, you can't do that. You have to generate some kind of foreign exchange to pay for the imports, right?
So unless
you can get the counterparty to just for all time take IOUs that never get cashed. Now, I don't think that is a plausible long-term scenario. You have to have, you know, a path of economic development that creates the means to pay for imports.
But until China wakes up to that.
Basically, I do agree with what David said. I mean, there are adjustment problems, and even to use that term kind of seems to minimize them. I mean, it is a big deal for the people who are thrown out of work, and we should have a more compassionate and effective policy for addressing that. But the big mistake, in my view, is to adopt the view, and I think this is what you're objecting to as well, is to adopt the view that trade with China or anybody else is hurting us in the aggregate. I think that's wrong, deeply, deeply wrong. And if we act on that presumption, then we are really shooting ourselves in the foot.
Clive, I've had this poor gentleman standing like Mount Rushmore for some
reason. Go ahead. Well, that's a more serious question on future social unrest in China. There's one factor we haven't discussed, and that's gender imbalance. You talked about oil shortage, you talked about water shortage. How about the pussy shortage?
Maybe I won't repeat the question. Yeah.
Talking.
You're on your own,
gentlemen. What about the consequences of gender imbalance in China because of the newborn, it's 100 city to 100 in some worse areas. One of the most talked about and alarming scenarios is that China will have an excess of young males, and that will lead to a more aggressive behavior. I dismiss that out of hand. I think that's not going to happen. What will happen is that in China, the price of women will go up. Women's status will improve because it's... and what will...
By the way, these remarks are not sponsored by DHL.
No. The status of women will go up. Who will suffer? China's neighbors will suffer. Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, even Thailand, because wealthy Chinese males will simply go to their neighboring countries to find mates. And then inland areas in China will see massive social problems in that particular area because women in those areas will marry more wealthy people from other areas. So that mostly will be contained within China and also around China's neighbors.
It's an interesting answer. Sir.
Yes. Corruption's a big problem. Related questions. How do you size it? What's the impact on the economy? What's the impact on the government? And can the Chinese do anything about it? What are their plans, and will they be successful?
I can start, and then Minxin can disagree with me. So I live in the suburbs of Beijing, mostly surrounded by foreigners who work for big international companies. I won't name any of them. But last thing we did before we left is have a goodbye party for some Dutch friends. And I asked that, because they've worked in so many countries in Asia, I asked this group, what was their perception of corruption in China versus Indonesia versus Vietnam versus Philippines, for example. And I think corruption's hard to measure, but complete uniformity among this group of foreign investors that the situation is much better in China than in other developing countries of Southeast Asia. In East Asia. I think it's hard to measure, but it's a problem throughout the developing world. It seems to be less of a problem in China because we don't see that kind of petty bureaucratic corruption that really stops business. So the customs administration is relatively clean. The police have become cleaner. I ask my middle class friends, I don't think people are going to be stopped and shaken down by police in the same way they are in many countries of developing Asia. So on a comparative perspective, I think China looks pretty good, and that's one reason why China's been so successful in attracting foreign investment and generating value. But now we can talk about big political corruption. I don't really know anything about.
No, I think if you compare China with the bottom of the pile, China always comes out looking pretty good. Because China is probably, if you give, say, 10 being least corrupt, 1 being most corrupt, China comes out around 4. Indonesia, Russia, India, around 3 to 2. So China look, but that's small comfort to people who actually have to live in the country with a scale, with a rank score of 4. The size of the corruption, I would say around 3% of GDP, which is significant but not fatal. This is a direct cost. And I'm not surprised that foreign businesses do not complain about corruption, because you pay a huge cost if you're a Chinese official, if you want to squeeze foreign businesses. They typically victimize domestic Chinese private entrepreneurs. They do not bother with big companies. That's why when foreign businesses say, oh, there's no corruption in China, I say, you don't have to deal with corrupt officials. So your experience is not representative. What does corruption do? Several consequences. First of all, it's actually a huge contributor to income inequality, because 3% of GDP gets stolen by a very small percentage of the elites, probably no more than a million. So that's really one-tenth of the population. So that's the other is that it it creates invisible costs because certain things that ought to be done do not get done. Economic inefficiency, that's again not possible to measure. But on the environmental front, so regulations that ought to be implemented, enforced, do not get enforced. So is that so if you have to bring everything in, I would say it's a lot more than 3%. When the economy is growing at 10%, you don't have to worry about losing 3%. The real issue is when the economy falls to, say, 6, 7%. Then 3% really hurts. Politically, what does it do? Corruption rarely brings down a government in a dramatic fashion. Corruption progressively weakens the legitimacy of the government. So the government pays when there is a huge crisis. The best example is Suharto's Indonesia, because Suharto's Indonesia was one of the most corrupt in modern memory. And it went on for a long time. But when there was no crisis, the regime survived with no problem. And people tend to discount corruption. But when there was this huge shock, then all of a sudden, it had no legitimacy left. So that's why I think the Chinese government is both worried about corruption and is impotent in dealing with it, because corruption is rooted in the current Chinese political economic system.
Seventy million
Chinese Communist Party members. To give you a joke in China, is that they say if you shoot every government official, you are going to kill some innocent people. But if you shoot half of them, you are going to leave a lot of guilty people free. So I'm I leave it to your imagination.
One more question.
Two parts real quick. Does there need to be some sort of domestic demand at any point for the economy to continue to grow? A great place to make shoes, not a great place to sell a lot of shoes outside of the fancy ones that get sold in the, to the high elite. And two, does the government feel it needs to expand its openness anymore if it wants to continue the growth over the next 10 or 15 years? Or does it feel it can stay fairly status quo and keep this economic miracle go on forever?
I think the China's been growing at above 10% for a while, and I don't think any economist really thinks that's sustainable or particularly healthy to continue that. We talk a lot about the sort of lack of consumption demand in China, but consumption is growing at 8% per year. So actually the economy's growth could slow down to 8%, right, and primarily be driven by the growth of consumption, and then it's easy to imagine a number of measures that would increase that growth. When I talk about increasing spending on health and education, you may find this ironic, but spending on health and education is considered consumption in the national accounts. So the most obvious way to increase consumption in China is just to spend a lot more on health and education. I think that would make people feel more secure, and then they would actually spend more on appliances and other kind of ordinary things of life. So I think they can accelerate consumption growth, and their trade, the growth of their exports could slow down quite dramatically, and you could still have a nice healthy equilibrium growing at around 8% per year, which anybody should be happy about.
So Minxin has given us one of his 120 days away from his family, and David is in from Beijing for these remarks. And Clive, I owe you a lot more thanks than just for this, but thank all three of you. We'll see you all this afternoon.